Hey, thanks for downloading the latest podcast from PeterBCollins.com. My efforts are supported by subscribers. Shall we name names? Janet Imus, Frank Barbara, Pauline Nixon, Ira Scott. You can subscribe too. And can you get some friends to subscribe? April is the month we're trying to double the number of people who support this program. We're giving away free copies of A Terrible Mistake, Hank Albarelli's chilling assembly of stories from the Cold War CIA experiments, including LSD, if you remember. Just go to PeterBCollins.com and sign up for a new membership. If you enroll for an annual $50 subscription or the $10 a month or higher level, you automatically get a signed copy of Albarelli's book. And for our $5 monthly minimum subscription, we're going to have a drawing at the end of the month, and five individuals will get a signed copy of Hank Albarelli's book. You're about to hear another Boiling Frogs interview, co-hosted with Sabelle Edmonds. And today, once again, we welcome James Bamford, the world's expert on the National Security Administration, the Spy Guys.
Everybody knows, but today, NSA's illegal domestic wiretapping, FBI's national security letters, state secrets privilege, TSA's 1 million-plus no-fly list, persecution of government whistleblowers, perpetual wars, rendition and torture. Can you feel the water boiling?
Welcome to the Boiling Frogs. With Sabelle Edmonds, I'm Peter B. Collins. Today, we welcome back the expert on the National Security Agency and America's intelligence networks. James Bamford is the author of The Shadow Factory, The NSA from 9/11 to the Eavesdropping on America, and also Body of Secrets, Anatomy of the Ultra-Secret National Security Agency, among other titles. Jim Bamford, welcome back to the Boiling Frogs.
Well, thanks, Peter and Sabelle. I really appreciate it. Great to be there.
Well, you do a lot of great work, and we want to start off with a recent article that you wrote for Wired Magazine. Take us to Utah, to the wilds where polygamists used to dominate, and now there is a huge new NSA complex scheduled to open next year.
Well, actually, polygamists still dominate in this town, the little town of Bluffdale, where NSA is building its enormous data center, the centerpiece of its 10-year-old construction project to build this infrastructure of surveillance. This little town of Bluffdale is going to have NSA's 1 million square foot, $2 billion data center to store all the intercepts that it collects from all around the world. And sharing this little town is the second largest sect of polygamists in the country, 9,000 polygamists. So it's going to be an interesting little town with all the polygamists and NSA people running around, each looking to the heavens for their separate messages.
Now, do you think it'll interfere with security clearances if somebody gets a job there and then gets his wife and then his other wife and then his third wife a job working for the government?
That might be a very interesting. I'd really love to do a story about that. The if the NSA starts hiring multiple wives for the data center there, but you know that is the biggest industry in the area is the data center. It's right now it's employing 10,000 people to build it,
mm-hmm.
And it's going to be, you know, one of the it actually is going to be the second largest data center in the entire country, and the only one bigger is just a few feet bigger, basically. And this one is going to be able to hold potentially a yottabyte of information, and that's if you took a yottabyte and you turned it into pages, it would be about 500 quintillion pages of
now,
text.
Now, my mental math only goes up to a terabyte. So where does Yoda come in the rank order?
Well, it's much further down the much further high up on the spectrum than terabyte. Yottabyte is actually the very end. After a yottabyte, there is no no one's come up with a name for another name after yottabyte. It's the most you can create, at least with the language we have right now.
I wish they'd
a tremendous amount of data, and the I quote from a Defense Department document where they're talking about the yottabyte of information potentially in terms of up in the ethersphere.
Mm-hmm. Now, I wish they had used terms that I can relate to, because I have memorized the size of wine bottles. And I believe the largest is the Nebuchadnezzar. Below that is the Jeroboam. So I wish they would apply that so that people like me would understand. Jim, there's another way that server farms are measured, and that is in megawatts, in the amount of power required to drive the servers and the cooling facilities, the air conditioning, that is essential to efficient operation. Do you happen to know what the megawatt rating is of this huge new data center?
Well, I think it's going to be 65 megawatts, which is enough to power about half of Salt Lake City, I think it is, or mm-hmm. at least its own small city. So it's an enormous amount of power. And one of the computers that they're developing down in Tennessee to try to break some of the codes, because a lot of the information in the data center will be encrypted, have enough. It would be, I think they're estimating 200 megawatts, which is enough to power about a city of about 200,000 people, and it will create so much heat, this one computer, that they'll have to use the same amount of cooling power that was used to cool the entire World Trade Center.
Wow. And where are they getting the electricity? Is the government generating this, or just buying it off the grid?
No, they're just buying it off the grid. There are a number of reasons why they moved it to, or they decided to build it in Utah. One is that the...
Orrin Hatch probably insisted.
Well, that's exactly right. That's certainly probably the biggest of all. The other one was they have some space there. There's a little-used army base, or there's an army base. It's actually used a fair amount, but there's a lot of empty space on it, which is where they're building it, Camp Williams. And the other reason, I guess, is the power out there is cheaper than it is a lot of other places, certainly a lot cheaper than it is in Maryland.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And, Jim, give us the overview, if you would. This huge new data center in Utah is in addition to, I believe there are massive server farms, if I remember correctly, one at Fort Meade, one in Colorado, and one in Texas. Are those correct guesses on my part?
Well, the largest one that they have that's sort of a backup to the one they have in Utah is in San Antonio, Texas, right. And it's almost the size of the Alamo Dome. But what's going on right now is this enormous construction project. So at NSA headquarters at Fort Meade, in May, they're going to take apart the golf course on Fort Meade, because NSA is expanding so much. They're going to build a new, I think it's a $1 billion supercomputer center there, and then they're going to build a cyber command there, a new cyber command. So NSA is just expanding by leaps and frogs.
And Jim, are these capital expenses, are they on the books through acts of Congress, or is all of this covered under the black budget?
No, everything that I'm talking about is, you could find out if you just dig through the military construction appropriations budget. It's all there. Mm-hmm. How much they would spend on certain things, maybe, some operation in a foreign country they might classify. But the NSA, it's in terms of building buildings and buying computers, they're mostly that information is mostly available. So, mm-hmm. So you can see how much they're spending in all these places. They're building. They just cut the ribbon a couple weeks ago on a brand new listening post in Georgia that will house about 4,000 people. Mm-hmm. Enormous.
All right. And just to complete my question, San Antonio, this new one in Utah.
Those are the two big storage areas.
Okay.
The others are basically listening posts and supercomputer centers. But in terms of storage, it's mostly the Utah and Texas.
Okay.
The others are used for listening posts, and the one in Colorado is at Buckley Air Force Base. It's the downlink for all the data that the NSA spy satellites pick up.
I see.
It transfers it all down to Buckley Air Force Base, this NSA facility there.
Mm-hmm.
And what will happen is the facility in the big data center in Utah will become what the term is a cloud. It will become NSA's cloud.
I see.
So that everything will go there, and then all the analysts from NSA headquarters and all the other locations in Georgia, Texas, and so forth will all, through fiber optic cables, analyze the intelligence held at that Utah facility.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And again, just as part of the overview, what are the other major facilities of NSA, in addition to what we've described, and of course headquarters is at Fort Meade, Maryland?
Yeah, they've got the headquarters at Fort Meade, Maryland, and I think they've got a 2.8 or $2.1 billion construction project there that's currently going on to expand headquarters. And as I mentioned, they have this very large listening post down in Georgia that focuses on eavesdropping on the Middle East, North Africa, and Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a very large listening post in San Antonio, Texas, that eavesdrops on South America, Central America, and also helps Georgia eavesdrop in the Middle East.
And it was the Georgia listening post where you interviewed some of the people who were monitoring the intercepts or translating the intercepts, and you revealed that many of them were deeply uncomfortable, particularly when they were tasked with monitoring calls from soldiers in Iraq to family members in the United States.
Oh, that's right. And it wasn't just soldiers in Iraq. It was journalists overseas, different countries. And they'd be calling up their families in the U.S. and having intimate, very personal conversations with their spouses and other members of their family. And the person I interviewed, Adrian Kinney,
yeah,
who was one of the intercept operators at the listening post in Georgia. And she said she felt very uncomfortable. She didn't want to do this kind of eavesdropping, but she was ordered to listen and ordered to transcribe. And she was one who protested internally in NSA and then protested to the Senate Intelligence Committee, neither of which did anything. And then she finally talked to me, and I quoted from her in both my last book, The Shadow Factory, and also in this article, in Wired.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was another person down there, another intercept operator, who said virtually the same thing, confirmed everything she said, and he was there later than her. So, and these are two very brave people that actually came forward and are speaking. And what's interesting is despite the threats from NSA, I've got a number of people I quote in the article that have gone on record and let me use their names and for their credibility and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Jim Bamford, coming back to the Wired article and this new facility being built in Bluffdale, Utah, First of all, I have to single out the best line in the article. You related earlier about the polygamists who populate the area, and you wrote, in the little town of Bluffdale, Big Love and Big Brother have become uneasy neighbors. There could be an HBO series in that. But I wanted to drill down on the encryption aspect of this, because there are people who believe that, for example, if they use Skype or the Google Voice over IP service, that they have at least a better level of protection from direct interception because of encryption that is used. Can you set us straight? Is there any means of telecommunication that can be encrypted to the point where the NSA cannot decipher it?
Well, it's hard to say exactly what their status is in terms of code breaking right now. It is true that VoIP, Voice over Internet Protocol, calls, which is like Skype and so forth, are more secure. It's more difficult for NSA to intercept those than because they're going over the Internet as opposed to the normal telephone channels. So it's more difficult. It doesn't mean that they can't do it, but from talking to a number of people, they do have more difficulty doing that. Also, I think BlackBerry is a bit more difficult for a number of reasons. I mean, they encrypt their information. Not that the NSA can't break all that. It can. It's just that it takes more time, and it's more of an effort and so forth. And breaking codes is a difficult task. I get into the NSA's efforts at code breaking to some degree in the article there, and how they're building this enormous computer in Tennessee, the world's fastest computer, to try to break some of these codes. They're working on a computer now that will be a exaflop in terms of speed. That's an enormous speed. They have a computer now that will do a petaflop, or several petaflops worth of speed, which is a quadrillion operations a second. Mm. So that's what they need. They need two things to break codes. They need a computer that is extremely fast, very, very super fast, because they have to do what's known as brute force. They have to take an enormous number of messages, and they have to go through those very quickly to look through every possible combination of the way the words are put together to mm-hmm. see if they could get what's known as plain text out of it.
Uh-huh.
So you need an enormous place, enormous amount of data to store to go through, and that's what Bluffdale is. And then you need an enormously fast computer to go through it all, and that's what they're building in Oak Ridge, Tennessee right now.
Mm-hmm. Fascinating stuff. We will link to the article in Wired Magazine so that our listeners can read that and catch up with some of the details from Jim Bamford's article. Jim, before we move on from that, is there anything else that's juicy in the story that you want to mention?
Well, the three main aspects are this very, very secret construction of the enormous data center. Then the I have a whistleblower, probably the highest level whistleblower. Probably it is the highest level whistleblower I've ever had, speaking about NSA's potential for eavesdropping domestically. His name is William Binney, and he was the person that was the technical director of the organization in NSA, a 6,000-member organization that did all the worldwide eavesdropping, and he was the person who was responsible largely for automating NSA's worldwide eavesdropping. And yeah, he goes on record talking about how we're just a half-inch away from a turnkey totalitarian society if NSA ever wanted to start doing wholesale domestic eavesdropping.
Mm-hmm. Jim, next I want to ask you about a case that we touched on last year when you spoke with us here on the Boiling Frogs, but you were limited because the case had not been fully resolved. And this relates to the NSA whistleblower Thomas Drake and you were hired by his legal team as a consultant. And I'm interested in learning more about the facts of the case and also the manner in which the government settled, because ultimately Drake pled guilty to, I believe, a single charge of misusing a government computer, a real minor slap on the wrist, but it saved face for the government. And, of course, he's SOL because he lost his security clearance and is no longer employable in the field where he works. And if I remember correctly, his wife also was retaliated against. And you can straighten me out on that when you respond to this. But I'm very interested in learning about more of the Drake case, because he basically tried to save the government $990 billion on a software system at the NSA. And the cheaper version that he was promoting had protections built in to preserve the constitutional rights of American citizens in the United States. So we not only lost a lot of money because they ignored Thomas Drake, but we lost serious constitutional protections. So take a couple of minutes here to explain the details of the Drake case, if you would.
Sure. The Drake was a senior official. He was a very senior NSA official. And he was very conscientious when it came to government waste, fraud, and abuse. And what he saw was that there were two programs that were being developed. One of them was extremely expensive, way over budget, and very convoluted. It was a program that NSA had been working on for a very long time called Trailblazer. And then there was another program called Thin Thread, which was basically the same thing. These two programs, what they were designed to do was to go through all the intercepted information as it's coming in and be able to identify communications that are of interest to NSA as it's going through the channels, and then would be able to kick that information out for NSA to further analysis. On the very large, expensive program, Trailblazer, there were no protections on the data. In other words, a phone call would come in or an email would come in, and it would come in just the way you would read it, or just the way you would listen to it. So it took away people's Fourth Amendment rights, their privacy on these communications. And it was very expensive and very cumbersome, this program. And then on the other one, Thin Thread, it had the advantage of being cheaper, did basically the same thing. But the biggest advantage was that the information, when it came through, would all be encrypted. And then if they did see something that was suspicious in that pile that would get kicked out, they would have to actually get a warrant before they could open it. So it provided the protection for all the communications going through the system. And for those reasons, Drake was pushing for that system to be adopted, but the agency wanted the system that was more expensive, more cumbersome, more over budget, and offered less protections. So he passed some information on to the Baltimore Sun about the debate, mm-hmm. and the information he passed on was unclassified. But the NSA, when they discovered that he had passed that information on, they really threw the book at him because they wanted to use Drake as an example. So what they did was they had him arrested and charged with 10 felony counts of espionage, which is, you know, outrageously excessive for what he did. Mm-hmm. And so I was hired by the public defender's office. He didn't have enough money for his own attorney at this point. So he was being defended by the Federal Public Defender's Office, which did a fantastic job. And I was hired to sort of take a look at the material they're charging him with and see if I could show that this material not only isn't secret or top secret or whatever, It's unclassified, and not only is it unclassified, it's been released into the public by, not just by reporters in the press, but actually by government officials at one time or another themselves. And it was difficult for me because I wouldn't take a security clearance. They wanted to give me one, but that would handicap me for my writing in the future, so yeah. I said I wouldn't. So I had to sort of try to figure out on my own what these documents were, what this information was, and then I was able to sort of figure it out. And then when I was able to do that, then I was able to show with about an 8-inch thick folder full of documents showing that the information they were alleging that Drake passed on that was highly classified and that caused him to be charged with those espionage counts were actually unclassified information and previously released by the government itself. So when the judge saw that information and the prosecution saw that information, they were very dumbfounded. So I was in there, and when the prosecution came back and they decided to drop the charges from 10 felony counts of espionage down to, well, basically what they did was they completely threw that entire case out. They threw out the entire charges on all that.
Mm-hmm.
And then they came back with a deal, and the deal was, we'll throw out all these charges, and if you plead to a single misdemeanor count of abusing your computer, you know, the same thing as if you went on Facebook while you're working on your government computer in the office.
Mm-hmm.
And the penalty for that was no jail time and no fine. So it was actually less than a parking ticket. So the prosecution had to go from 10 and NSA, 10 felony counts of espionage, down to less than a parking ticket. And the high point came in the final day when everybody had to go back into court, and the judge basically praised Drake and threw the book at the prosecutor for wasting the court's time, the government's money, for 4 years, and putting Drake through hell for 4 years. So I'd never seen. I've got a law degree myself, and I've been in courtrooms numerous times, but I've never seen a judge throw the book at a prosecutor like this, and also at NSA, they were working together. So
now, Jim, do you see
a tremendous victory for Drake, and also for the principle that if you battle the government, you can win sometimes. And it mm-hmm. was a tremendous indictment on the government for bringing a case that should never have been brought.
And Jim, given that and the judge's commentary, do you think there's a cause of action similar to what occurred in the prosecution of Senator Ted Stevens, where a report just came out a week ago, blistering, it's not an indictment in the legal sense, but a blistering criticism of the manner in which the prosecutors handled this? Do you think there's at least the potential for an investigation into the Drake prosecution?
It's hard to say. It'd be very nice. The irony here is the same prosecutor. It's William Welch. William Welch was the prosecutor who was the subject of this investigation of the prosecution of Ted Stevens.
Mm-hmm.
He was the lead prosecutor on the case, and he's the one who's responsible for all the prosecutorial misconduct that took place. This was a devastating report that came out. And he's the same prosecutor that did the prosecution in Drake, and now he's prosecuting another leak case. I think they picked him to be sort of the lead prosecutor in all these leak cases, but he's doing having such a devastatingly bad go at it. How many prosecutors could survive the debacle of the Ted Stevens case if they brought him back to do the Drake case and other cases? So,
and the new case you're referring to, is that the CIA guy who exposed the waterboarding of Abu Zubaydah?
He's a CIA former CIA I think he was in the clandestine service, the operations department of NSA.
Mm-hmm.
And he's the one who allegedly leaked to Jim Risen in the New York Times for Risen's book that he did.
I see.
I can't remember his name right now, but he was the his case is being prosecuted by William Welch also.
That's just amazing. Sibel, you had a comment?
Yes. When we start weighing the goods and the bads from Drake's case, what do you think, Jim, is the overall result as far as whistleblowers go? Because with, you know, my experience when I'm talking with the whistleblowers or those who are in the process of making decisions to blow the whistle, it really had a chilling effect because they were talking about, well, this administration actually is not only, you know, persecuting you, they are actually prosecuting you. And this administration has been using the Espionage Act, et cetera. On the other hand, with the results, well, Drake took them on, and basically the government really lost. And it really looked awful bad. So when you look at this entire case overall, how do you see the implications of this case on future whistleblowers in terms of discouraging, encouraging, chilling effect?
Well, I think it will have a discouraging, I certainly think the Drake case will have a discouraging effect on future prosecutions because of the enormous embarrassment that the government had. It was, this was front page news all over the place. The Drake case was, it had a double segment on 60 Minutes, it had a 10,000 word article in The New Yorker, was front page New York Times and the Washington Post, and the government was, this is the big deal. This is the government's case, because what the government needs in these whistleblower cases is it needs documents. At least that's in the past, that's what they've always looked for. They've gone after the cases where there's actual documents that they can show. And in this case, they had these documents. The problem was they were saying that the documents were highly classified, and in reality, they weren't classified at all. I mean, in reality, the government had given away the same information itself. So that was a big blow. And this new case that we just talked about, the new case involving this CIA official.
I think you're looking for John Kiriakou. Is that the right name?
No, that's the most recent case.
Yeah.
Jeff Sterling?
Yeah, Sterling. That's
okay.
Sabella, the Sterling case. And the problem with that case is they apparently don't have documents, or at least they don't have the right documents or very good documents or whatever. And if you don't have documents, then the only other thing you can do is you have to call the reporter. You have to present some evidence, and the best evidence for these espionage charges for whistleblowers is actual documents that have been passed. But in that case, it sounds like they don't really have documents, at least that they can get their hands on, so they're resting their case largely on subpoenaing James Risen, who was the author of the book, who also works for the New York Times, although the information wasn't in the Times, it was in his book. And they're having a very hard time because he's fighting subpoenas to testify. So if he's able to win and not testify, the case would likely be thrown out because they won't have any way to present any evidence against Sterling. So if you have those two cases, which were two of the lead cases, being thrown out, then that's a really large, devastating loss for the government going after these cases. But Obama has been the lead president in terms of going after these cases. He's gone after, I don't know what it was.
I think it's six different cases now.
Six, and there's only been a couple, all the other presidents combined.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's very disconcerting to see that this president who came in claiming that he wanted to bring more openness to government is doing everything he can to make sure there is as little openness as possible.
Well, he was the winner of that Secret Transparency Award.
That's right. Well, you know, he was the person who came, was campaigning early on about how he would not only vote against expanding the or authorizing this Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Amendments Act, which basically ratified the warrantless eavesdropping, he not only would vote against it, he'd filibuster against it. And he'd also vote against giving immunity to the telecommunications companies for their part in the illegal eavesdropping. And in both cases, he completely backtracked when push came to shove, and he voted in favor of both. So he's, again, he's somebody who will try to draw the left in, or the more liberal part of the constituency in, but then when a push comes to shove, he'll take those votes for granted and do things to appeal to the right.
Well, and Jim, you may not have heard this before, but I coined the term left lawn. You know that Reagan was the Teflon president, and I believe Obama went to DuPont and got the new and improved left lawn so that nothing that comes from the left will stick.
Exactly, yeah. It's quite amazing how you can vote for a president and see this enormous transition as soon as he gets into office, where he's greatly expanded on the whole eavesdropping aspects, and which is the area I follow quite closely. And then he's gone after anybody who tries to point out things the government's doing wrong, like in the Drake case.
Yeah. Sibel, I know you have a comment. I'll go to you next, but I just wanted to mention that while we were talking, I did an Google search for CIA whistleblower Jeff Sterling, and the third result that comes up is a link to Boiling Frog's post. You're doing great work there.
Well, sure. I'll congratulate you on
that.
It
just shows how bad the mainstream media has been.
Well, I'm afraid that's true, too.
Jim, with all the stuff that we've had with that has to do or deals with the collusion between these our military and intelligence agencies and the private sector. You know, we have NSA and AT&T and other telecom. Then we have the Blackwater, the now XE, and I believe they just sold or they changed name again between Pentagon and them. And then we had these this latest scandal with Stratfor. That their emails were hacked. And, of course, we have all the other companies, one after another. Just wanted to take a few minutes with you and have you tell us about the implications of this incestuous relationship and this partnership slash collusion between the private firm and the intelligence agency. Privatization of Intel. Now you have government and the corporation with all this data that belongs to you.
Well, it is a really major problem. I wrote an op-ed for the New York Times about it back in 2008, I think it was. And when I was doing that, I was looking around and I saw that these companies would actually go into the. There's just enormous numbers of these companies that nobody's ever heard of, obscure names. They surround the Beltway of Washington. And recruiters all have high clearances. All these companies have high clearances, and the recruiters would actually go into CIA. They have access to the CIA and other agencies. And they'll go into the lunchroom, and they'll see prospects. They'll see people that have been pointed out to them as people who they may be able to hire. And they'll go and basically suggest that they can double their salary, and if they join the company, and it's a very tempting offer, and these people often do it. The problem for the taxpayer is the taxpayer just spent an enormous amount of money recruiting the person, putting him through all kinds of several years of training to bring the person up to a capability to do their job at the CIA, and then spent several years there, actually perfecting their skills and becoming a good employee. And then at that point, when they can start, the taxpayer basically can start benefiting from all that money and training that the person has used, that's when the recruiters come in and scoop them up. And so the taxpayer ends up paying for basically a training ground for these private corporations, and then the person leaves, goes to work for the company. The taxpayer ends up paying twice as much now for the employee because the contractors charge twice as much as the employee would have charged, because the employee is getting a lot more money, and then the company has to get more money. And then the agency has to go out and start all over again and recruit somebody from the very beginning and start that whole chain all over again, the training. So it's a brain drain. It's a very big drain on the taxpayers for having this happen. But it's also a very scary thing because you have people that have no real oversight. I mean, these are people working for private companies nobody's ever heard of. Most people in Congress have no idea how many of these people are working for private contractors, and they're doing the things that the American public, I think, assumes are being done solely by government employees who are accountable because they work for the government, they're on government payroll, and they could be called for Congress to say, why are you doing this or why are you doing that? So these companies are now taking over jobs like running agents, running clandestine agents, the CIA, doing CIA analysis. And at the NSA, it's just as bad. The NSA has largely outsourced a lot of its, basically its entire eavesdropping operation. So now it's two outsourced companies that do a lot of the actual tapping of the telecommunications lines in the United States and around the world, particularly like the big AT&T switch in San Francisco, and that's all the gear in there and all the software and hardware and everything, and it comes from a company called Naris, and then for Verint, they use a company called, Verizon, they use a company called Verint. So you have the actual tapping being done by companies that are outsourced, and then
Jim, if I may, not only are they outsourced, but Naris has very close ties to Israeli intelligence, to retired Mossad officers.
Well, actually, both of those companies are were formed in Israel by Israelis, and there are I don't detail actual connection to the Mossad, but there are connections to intelligence organizations within within Israel that both of these companies have had connections to Israeli intelligence. Verint, for example, was formed by a former Israeli intelligence agent. I think he's more military intelligence than Mossad, but the point is that there's these Israeli connections to companies that are heavily involved in the actual putting the software and hardware in place to do all the eavesdropping. A lot of those people actually have left Naris now, and Naris is now owned by Boeing. So you've got all these contractors that are actually doing the first step, which is actually doing the tapping, and then you've got all these other contractors that are also doing the listening now, the eavesdropping. Lockheed Martin, Boeing, FCIC, all these companies now are actually hiring people, and then the NSA would hire their people, who largely were former NSA people, to go to the listening posts and put on the earphones and do the eavesdropping. So you've got the entire spectrum of NSA's eavesdropping activities, from bugging the line, the communications lines, to doing the actual interception, the transcription, and the listening, all being done by unaccountable contractors.
Right, and actually that was going to be my follow-up question, and that is the implication for oversight and accountability and Congress, because once you have these lines blurred, I mean, who really has the oversight of the big companies, whether it's the FDIC or it's the AT&T or it's Blackwater, you're looking at no oversight.
Well, not only that, I think there's been surveys done in Congress where there's nobody in Congress that he has even an idea of how many of these contractors are out there. And again, it's not something that they have been really paying much attention to. And as you mentioned, it's a real key issue dealing with accountability. I mean, a government employee is a government employee. They work for the government. They're accountable to the government. And yet these other people are not accountable. They're accountable to private corporations that nobody ever heard of that are very black in terms of very secret companies. And it's just expanding and expanding and expanding, and not just, like I said, the CIA, but the NSA and other intelligence agencies also.
Can't we use this advantage actually to their disadvantage? Meaning, I mean, it's very hard or impossible to go and sue NSA, you know, and talk about monetary lawsuits when you have a, you know, large group coming together, a class action. But shouldn't we be able to, because they are private, and when these issues are reported on, and once in a while it happens, you know, what we are seeing with Stratfor, what we got to see with Blackwater, AT&T, for example, and then really push them from the legal side and for the public to actually challenge them in court, since basically it has become impossible to challenge the government, federal government. I mean, I know Obama gave immunity to AT&T, but on the other hand, maybe if we were to push Obama's hands or any administration to keep going around and giving immunity to all these companies, maybe then we will get some spine growing on our majority people.
Well, it's possible, and that's a it's one area. I was actually a plaintiff in the very very first suit against NSA for the warrantless eavesdropping, and we won in the lower court. We had a very favorable opinion by the district court judge, and then when we got up to the appeals court, it was three judges, and two of them were appointed by Bush, one by Clinton, so we lost 2-1, and that was based not on the substance of the suit, but on the fact that we couldn't prove that we were eavesdropped on, because NSA doesn't say who they eavesdrop on. But that case was the ACLU brought a new case almost identical to the one we lost, and that one has progressed one step. An appeals court has approved it, and now NSA is appealing to the Supreme Court. So it shows that there is some possibility of winning against these companies, and I think that that should be one of the areas that should be focused on. I mean, one of the other areas that's a big problem in having all these outsourced intelligence organizations is that they're also not susceptible to the Freedom of Information Act. If you have a listening post and there are people there that are doing illegal eavesdropping, and you try to find that information out through a Freedom of Information Act or try to get documents that point in that direction, I mean, that's a theoretical possibility, but it's impossible if this is a company running the operation, because the company is not susceptible to a Freedom of Information Act.
Jim, we recently interviewed John Eisenberg here on the Boiling Frogs podcast. He's the attorney who did win a wiretapping case here in San Francisco, and the government is now appealing it. They did win a judgment and minor money damages and legal fees, and Judge Von Walker ruled that they had been illegally wiretapped. So the standing issue there that was used to flush out your case that Judge Anna Diggs Taylor in Detroit ruled favorably on didn't cause this case to go. They now can't sue the phone companies because of the FISA reform immunity component, but they can sue the government. We, of course, know that the state secret privilege will prevent that from probably becoming anything meaningful. But I wanted
to... That's the ultimate trump card that the agency will play if push comes to shove.
Yes. I wanted to ask you about one other aspect of this privatization of intelligence and intelligence gathering activities, and that is what I would call bleeding black. You talked about how employees of the CIA and the NSA are recruited, and when they move into the private sector, they keep the black information, secret, top secret information that they were exposed to when they had a government job. And so it's not only the drain on human resources, but it is, to me, the sharing of the most sensitive secrets that can move from government into the private sector. And as you just pointed out, they are unaccountable to Congress and not responsive to the Freedom of Information Act. So that becomes the kind of blackest of black cells, and it can be exploited for corporate profit. That to me, is a real egregious fundamental violation.
Well, that happens all the time because there's such a fast-moving revolving door between the government and private industry, the contractors. So they go into government, they get find out a lot of good secrets, and then they leave, and they go into the corporate world and make a lot of money with it. Then they go back into government, learn more secrets, come back out and join the same company or another company and make much more money again. And when you look at it in the sense that this is information that a lot of times is probably going overseas because a lot of these companies are multinational companies, or, you know, foreign companies entirely, and there's very little oversight. So you have a case where Drake leaks some minor information that's not even classified to a newspaper so that the public can find out about some wrongdoing that's going on, and he gets charged with 10 counts of espionage, and yet these other companies are basically passing information on to either directly or indirectly to foreign organizations or foreign governments through their corporate ties. And so that you pointed to a very good area that's never really examined by Congress.
Well, and Jim, to take it one step further, I can imagine a kind of eBay for black ops. And one example, this may seem a little trivial, that comes to mind, is that in the Nova documentary that you produced for PBS based on the Shadow Factory, you explained that you came into possession of Osama bin Laden's satellite telephone number. And that has to have some value to somebody. And you can imagine an auction format where people who have access to the most sensitive secrets that we hold could put it up for bid and say, hey, who wants Bashar Assad's iTunes information and you know, whether he's actually watched the Harry Potter movie yet or not.
Right, and that might have solved all our problems if some company bought Osama bin Laden's cell phone and they kept loading it with robocalls, and so he ended up not using it anymore. So, but yeah, exactly. Well, this whole area, as you mentioned, there are so many different aspects of it that have never been explored and that are potentially, harmful to the American public in terms of both information loss and also financial loss. But Congress, again, pays no attention to that. You know, it's interesting. The Senate Intelligence Committee was formed in around 1975 by Frank Church after a series of scandals, and he was very aggressive. And the whole idea of the committee back in those days, and all the senators and congresspeople on the House side of it, were very aggressive going after the intelligence agencies and acting as or considering themselves a buffer between the intelligence agencies and the American public. And over the years, because these people just end up working so closely with the intelligence community and have so little contact with actual constituents that are being spied on, that there's the congressional committees have turned, instead of being watchdogs, they've turned into basically cheerleaders for the intelligence agencies. So instead of like Church going after the NSA for domestic eavesdropping, they're cheering these intelligence agencies on and pressuring administrations to give these agencies more money and more freedom. So that leaves a void, a complete vacuum when it comes to oversight and acting as a buffer between the intelligence agencies and the American public.
Well, and the current chair of the Intelligence Committee in the Senate is my senior senator from here in California, Dianne Feinstein, and it appalls me to see what she has done and what she has supported over the last 9 or 10 years. There's one exception. She recently felt that the National Defense Authorization Act and its embedded homeland battlefield bill went too far in permitting an American citizen to be held without charge or trial indefinitely if accused of terrorists or terrorist ties. And she has sponsored some legislation to clarify that and to exclude American citizens residing in the United States. That's the only good thing I can say about Senator Feinstein, and she is cruising to re-election this year with only nominal opposition from the Republican Party here. So she's going to be in the mix. She's getting older, but probably as long as she lives. And she is just a total booster and apologist for the expanded intelligence operations that, you know, in my view, form a police state here in the United States.
Well, exactly. And that was the point I was trying to make, is that the you compare that that attitude and that that type of performance with the attitude and performance of the intelligence committees under Church and in those early days. Then Senator Bayh came after Church, and they were. That was a very aggressive time. They took that job seriously, and they considered that the job was to look out for the American public and see what these agencies are doing, and it's just gone completely the opposite direction.
And that's Senator Birch Bayh, the father of Evan Bayh, who was not nearly as principled, who also served in the United States Senate. Well, Jim Bamford, it's always a pleasure to talk with you, and I learned so much. Is there a new Bamford book in the works?
No, not right now. I'm working on a couple other articles right now, but I enjoy sort of doing these articles. I don't have to spend 3 years on them like I do for a book. Mm-hmm. I'll do another book at some point, but right now it's fun doing these articles because I'm able to look at some very important topics and get them into print in much less time than it would take to write a book.
Jim Bamford, thank you for joining us today on The Boiling Frogs.
Thank you, Jim.
Well, thank you both. I really appreciate being on your show. Thanks again.
On us. Thank you for joining us. We'll be back soon with more Boiling Frogs interviews.